Welcome back to Kia Company's Influencer Insights podcast. You are listening to the second part of our podcast on the new types of industry analysts. We are joined by Michael Cote, William Tinkup, Horace De Jeu, and Phil First. Happy listening.
To your point, Phil, do you feel that the new analysts are a real threat to the legacy firms at this stage? Or do you feel the fact that you mentioned the decoupling of the model and finding new ways to get into the company and different sources of revenue hasn't really hit home the impact on Gartner's and Forrester's revenue?
I don't think individual analysts are going to threaten Gartner, for example. I think what you'll see is maybe a big vendor they'll still spend money with Gartner because they want to buy the quadrants and all that stuff. But they may hire the smart individuals to do strategy sessions with them, because I've had the complaint so many times that if you get the B analysts or the C analysts coming along, the vendors get very upset. So I think what will happen is, and what is happening, is vendors start to spend money more strategically from a marketing perspective with the legacy firms, but they invest more in the individuals for sounding board validation, that sort of thing. Can I just rewind to why we got into this business? Because I think one thing that we missed out on today's discussion is the fact that the analyst industry is a victim of its own enjoyment. So being an analyst is probably the best job in the world. You're paid to educate yourself, fly around the world, give speeches, get your ego stroked on many occasions. It's a great job. Who wouldn't enjoy doing that? You've just got to work hard at it and be very passionate about it. The problem is that in the 90s, when I was starting out, everyone thought you'd be an analyst for maybe 3 or 4 years and then you'd go get a proper job. You really did. Yeah. You didn't think it would be a career. No one did. What happened is it was so much fun, there was so much money pumped into it, that everyone decided they wanted to stay as analysts. And there was no succession plan. So if you were covering, I don't know, CRM or HR or whatever in one of the big legacy firms, you would make damn sure there wasn't a successor behind you who could take your job, right? So there was no younger generation of analysts coming up. And you go to an analyst conference now, the average age is over 50. It's embarrassing, right? I mean, it's an industry hurtling towards retirement. There's no succession plan in play. And where is the youth? Where is the passion? Where are the millennials in this business? They've disappeared. I'm not joking. I went to a conference, I think it was Dell last year, and there were people I hadn't seen for 20 years from IDC who I thought were old 20 years ago, who were literally walking around this conference. I think, my God, these people are still working? And it's unbelievable. I mean, the succession issue is one of the biggest threats to this industry as we look at what can we do to fix this.
And do you feel that also hampers innovation, because everyone knows people are not keen on big change?
Absolutely.
So they like change, God, but not for themselves.
Absolutely. I know analysts, and I'm not going to name names today, but I know analysts who all they do is go to vendor conferences and blog about it and then get paid. That's their job. They go to vendor events, they write about them. They go to vendor events, they write about them. That's all they do. They're not analysts. They're marketing sandwich boards for whoever's picking up their travel tabs. And that is where the industry is going, and that needs to be arrested quickly. I think there is a recognition from some of the vendors that they need to stop funding this, but at the same time, what do they care? It's easy, controllable, inexpensive way to, you know, make themselves look good and get, you know, executive bums on seats. That's what they do.
To sum up, who are the new analysts, that's a bit more enjoyable, or at least a positive vibe I'm getting from this, is that the new analyst is very authentic, very passionate about this topic, puts a community central, likes to share and educate, and also is able to really bring the message across and communicate to it. So that should be a recipe at least for some innovation. And the next topic I want to touch upon is what are the forces that is driving this disruption, and who better to ask the first question to than Horace. Like you said, You're involved with the Clayton Christensen Institute. So from a disruptive innovation perspective, how do you analyze the industry research ecosystem?
Yeah, it's well. Actually, to be honest, again, you know, shows my lack of professionalism. I don't know the industry all that well. I mean, the fact is that I mean, when I was at Nokia, I actually was a customer of the industry. Although maybe I should say user. The company would buy a lot of information, and then I would have access to it. So I was consuming the work, but I don't know if I understood quite ever the way the industry works. I've known people over the years in it, but it wasn't the topic that I was interested in, actually, to know how that works. I kind of stumbled into it. But if I could just give it a very rough thumbnail sketch, it seems that the incumbent firms, and I'm speaking of Gartner, IDC, have become over-serving in the disruption language. Is that they actually are delivering a lot of product across a lot of categories, often without a great deal of true insight, in the sense of, you know, making the causal statements. What they're doing is they're delivering lots of data, but not lots of insight. And this is the measure of performance that they've been graded on, which is, have you got data on this and this and this? And so they would say yes, and what would you like more? Would you like something new? And they would offer more and more data. But when you read the commentary on this, so let's say on the personal, I'll give you an explicit example. In the personal computer industry, for years they were tracking that industry without really paying attention to the potential of either tablets or smartphones to take away a lot of the work that was being done on PCs. So they never really thought about the future of the PC industry, just looking ahead one or two quarters. If they did make long-term forecasts, they would be saying that it would continue with the same growth forever. It was interpolating or extrapolating an existing pattern forever. And there wasn't a great deal of insight about what really makes the industry grow in the first place, and therefore what might cause it to fail. There are many, and the funny thing is that a lot of people who are true thought leaders in the industry, they're sort of mocking these guys, and they, you know, they would dig up forecasts from 5 years ago and show just how bad they were, how they were, they're predicting the PDAs would take over the world, or that Windows Mobile would be the number one platform for smartphones, and all these, you know, crazy claims that were made just a few years ago by supposedly the most best informed analysts in the industry. And so what it means to me is, again, throughout this process, they're getting paid very well, and they're getting paid and rewarded for doing that. And so the challenge is that those who ask different questions, or even ask questions at all about the future and what's really going on, were not being rewarded. So the firms who were buying this research actually wanted to hear these rosy forecasts. They wanted to hear, because they were themselves the buyer of the research was providing on the other side the data about their own business, so they wanted to see a reflection of themselves, and they wanted to see a validation of their core beliefs, and those were the companies that were being disrupted. And so this is the problem that when I talk about over-serving, is that they were doing a lot of that, and at the same time, somebody would come in with a quote-unquote stupid questions and say, wait a minute, maybe this whole industry is going to go away, and here's how. And so those are the voices that were suddenly right, and they're now getting a lot more recognition. Now, what does that mean, that there'll be an immediate disruption? Again, it all depends on whether this low-end entrant can actually become big enough, or, you know, if there's it's not that they're going to take away the budget from that organization, but they'll probably create new budgets for themselves in new ways of monetization. So I'm not suggesting that, you know, there's a there's a truly a wealth transfer going to happen, but rather that there's a potential for the old market to sort of slowly subside and a new market to be created, which is actually completely different. And that's that you know, new business models, and, you know, something around the you know, more consultative perhaps, more about, you know, being hired as a speaker rather than as a report writer, being hired more as a brand. Who knows? I haven't thought through how it happens. I'm just going along for the ride, and it's really exciting.
Yeah. So if I ask you the question, are you deliberately trying to disrupt industry analysis, or is this your business model and the way you go about it a byproduct of your chosen route?
It's absolutely not deliberate at all, because in fact, like, I had no interest in even doing this, and I know I'm just following my passion. I enjoy doing this. I enjoy having an audience and getting them to make me smarter. I feel like really my objective is to get better at what I do. That's it, you know, full stop. There's no need to make others suffer or anything like that, or take money from anybody at all. It's just really following an interest that I have, and again, I think those are the successful disruptors are motivated passionately for getting better at something, and they don't really care if something they don't see it as an obstacle. They're just following their instincts. Steve Jobs making an MP3 player, he didn't go out, you know, on the trajectory and, you know, say, oh, we're going to destroy Sony someday, we're going to destroy music retail. He just wanted to make a good device and maybe be profitable doing that, and that's it. You know, the disruptions happen as a side effect. It's almost collateral damage to building great things. That's why it's what I call asymmetric competition. They're not really symmetrically attacking, right? They're not trying to be doing a frontal assault. So asymmetric is completely subversive, but again, not deliberately so.
And the strategy is emergent.
Absolutely, yes, exactly. To use the parlance of Christensen, it's not a deliberate, it's an emerging strategy that you're just, you know, constantly learning and pivoting as you go along.
Right. And Cote, in your blog, you mentioned, I don't see a head-on assault on the incumbents succeeding in the short term or even ever. How do you, as a outsider right now from the industry, looking in, what do you see as the main driving forces behind this disruption? And is there even an assault going on, or is it these emergent strategies that disrupt the industry?
Well, you know, you always have to mention things in serial, and I don't mean the order. I'll go over these things to imply their priority. It's just the order they're spoken in. But I think one of the main things that causes a hole in the ability to change, that is, or creates that breach, if you will, is in the IT world, broadly speaking, there's a tremendous amount of change going on that I don't think we actually saw a similar amount of change except back when we used to have lowercase e-commerce and things like that back in the late 90s and early 2000s. Like Horace was mentioning, there was this swap out of the PC, of the Wintel empire, to a totally different thing. Obviously not overnight, but in a relatively short amount of time. And you see similar switches happening in all parts of the IT world, right? Switching from on-premise package software to SaaS software. And, you know, the software development frameworks have been switching around madly over the past couple of years, and then the infrastructure used to run them has been moving around. So there's a lot of chaos going on, and this creates, for people who cover the industry in a traditional way, it screws up their models and their framework and the way they look at things. Back when I was at Dell doing cloud strategy and M&A, we spent a lot of time basically getting the raw spreadsheets from analysts and changing the model around so that we would have consistent quarter over quarter and year over year numbers, because the categories would change so much that, and the analysts wouldn't change them around, that you had to adapt their work because their model of the world of IT didn't really map the model we were seeing as much. So when you have this much change and chaos happening, you need new information. You like there's an opportunity to write about new things and do new things, not just writing about IT topics in the same old way. And I think coupled with this force, if you will, is the fact that, and again, this is hyperbolically put, but anyone can publish and anyone can build a community if they're willing to spend all of the energy or the sweat, blood, and tears and rack up family debt to do it, right? So, you know, I remember one of the early podcasts that Ben Thompson did on his Exponent one. He spoke about, like, yeah, there were like 2 years there where I slept 4 hours a night.
Yeah.
And so he was willing to expend the energy to build up a community. And because we have, you know, the internet and everything that's in that, it really opens up that channel that wasn't really there. As it's been there for a decade or more, but it's really there now. And I think that's the other part of it, is that people, at least in my experience, people trust quote-unquote random stuff they find on the web or in Twitter. They put a lot more credence into coherent, good-sounding arguments that they find. And whether or not it's from like a Gartner or a Forrester or whoever else and has the seal of approval is not always that important, as important as it used to be. And so there's almost, just like, you know, in the early 2000s, people trusted using credit cards on the internet. Now people trust information they get. And yeah. So I think along with probably numerous other things, when you put all those things together, one, there's the need for new coverage because the old models and frameworks aren't working. Two, the means of production can be had by anyone who can, you know, put in the effort to do them. And then three, whenever they actually, when you publish, like it's a lot easier to be trusted. So you don't need all the brand power that an analyst firm gives you necessarily. It really does create this force where it opens up the possibility for more and more people to become analysts. Now, to be a little dour, like one of the main points of that blog post I was writing up is that for me, the question has always been, as an individual, can I get the amount of sustainable revenue I need to like live my life and my family's life in this position? Because yeah. I would love to be being an analyst, but I'm not quite sure if I can yet bring in enough revenue and all the other stuff compared to what I can get as I'm doing now working at a vendor in a marketing firm. Yeah. And so I think things are positive there and they're looking up. But that's kind of the next thing that needs to follow, is that economically the numbers will work out for more and more people to be an individual analyst, because everything else is there, but you got to you know, make sure that you can buy those shirts that your kids need for school and things like that.
The real world things need to happen as well, indeed.
Yeah, the real world's always screwing up our beautiful utopia.
In terms of needs and preferences of users, and so Kote mentioned the changing chaos bring about the need for new information and new coverage areas and all that kind of stuff. William, you're almost a year old, your firm. What have you learned about the needs and the preferences of your users and clients?
Well, you know, I work in an area where HR, so the people we serve are practitioners of HR, and that's a lot of different types of people, I would tell you. The deep irony of HR is that they don't share. They don't share with each other. And so they don't talk about failure, about success. They just don't talk. And so you have a group of people that don't talk to one another, and you have education that's brought to them by vendors. Both on the services layer and the vendor layer. And so I think Phil said something earlier that I really believe in, that everyone publishes. There's this line of noise, and everyone kind of feeds that noise. In my little world, the narrative of HR is wrong. It's not actually what goes on in HR. It's what people blog about. It's what's salacious. It's yellow journalism. It's vendor sponsored. I mean, when the Harvard Business Review puts out a magazine on blowing up HR, it's ludicrous if you talk to real HR practitioners. So you've got this noise level that's deafening, and I think that if you look at that in our little space, you say, well, information is a commodity, and everyone, they can't discern quality, and so information isn't the game, it's really knowledge. well, how do you get knowledge into the hands of the people that can really do something and really need it, becomes a game for John and I of how you build that audience. And so we have podcasts, and we have a lot of different ways to reach that audience, but we're on an endless pursuit of trying to reach not the vendor community, because you know, I've worked with 700 software firms. I'm comfortable with the vendor community. It's getting more and more comfortable with the audience of HR. There's 7 million people that work in HR. I'd like to know every single one of them. And I'd like for them to know us and trust us, as many people have said. So on some level, I think if you look at our little bee piddly firm, you say, okay, we've got to deliver knowledge. We've got to deliver either validating things that they already know, and say, yep, that actually is true, or tell them things that they don't know, which I think is more valuable when you say, actually, the world's flat, and here's why. And you kind of take them through an odyssey of, okay, well, all the shit that you're reading is garbage, and so stop reading it, A. B, there's a new reality, and here's the new reality, and here's how we got there. And kind of, instead of being godlike, which I think is a failure of all traditional types of firms, actually admitting vulnerability and admitting failure and admitting curiosities, and saying, hey, we don't have all the answers. We're just curious. We're going to go and try and figure it out, and as we do, we'll tell you what we learn. That resonates with a lot of people that we talk to, because they're tired of the godlike mantra of a lot of folks. But the last thing I'd say is niche. There's this old phrase of riches and niches. And I think, you know, if I ever had a question, like I've been following Phil's career for a long time. If I ever had a question, so if a client came to me and said, hey, we're thinking about acquiring an outsourcing firm, or we're really thinking about making a global play and doing some things more of on an outsourcing basis, the first call I'd make, or actually who I'd put them in touch with, would be Phil, who knows that space better than anyone in the world.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a great, like, what he's done, and there's a lot of great examples, Jim Lundy at Aragon. There's a lot of great examples of guys that have just said, I don't need to know everything. I'm just going to go and focus on this one thing, and I'm going to know it better than anybody in the world. And I think people trust that. I think the buyers, the users, I think everyone trusts that more than someone that says, no, I know everything.
Right, and that brings me to the... Indeed, to the question, does size matter? You see a lot of smaller, more focused firms coming up. All the new analysts are obviously, you don't start out as a big, comprehensive firm like Forrester or Gartner. That's impossible. But this is a broader question. Do any one of you expect one of the new firms to rise to be a Gartner or Forrester size, an organization with a comprehensive coverage, or do you really feel the smaller, specialized niche firms are the future, and that can be even the one-man analyst shops or slightly bigger?
If someone had told me 5 years ago that we'd have 20 full-time employees globally, I would have thought you were smoking something. So I don't think you plan to grow. You grow because you're good, and people want to spend and invest more. I do think we're moving to an era of more micro boutiques that are very specialized. It sort of begs the question, what's the ideal size for an analyst firm? I personally think it's under 50 employees, because you can collaborate, you can be global, you've got enough skills and expertise to really give the clients what they want. Someone said to me the other day, a very famous analyst at Gartner said to me, Gartner is 20 great analysts support, literally propping up an archaic organization. You know, you can run a great analyst organization with maybe 6-7 really well-known market-facing analysts and a good support team around them. And then in today's economy, you can be so global, cloud-driven. You don't need to have offices everywhere. You need to have maybe one or two. So I would say if this industry does survive, we'll see several successful under 50 employee firms continuing to do well.
Yeah, I this is William. I think it's the singer-songwriter example comes to me because I'm in Dallas, Texas, and it's close to Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. As a singer-songwriter, you don't think about playing stadiums, because if you do, you're already dead in the water. You just go out and do your best. You serve your clients. And if your customers take you there, I think, you know, Phil's right on. If your customers take you there because you're good, great, go. But forcing the matter, I think, is where failure. I mean, I love entrepreneurs that start up and then they talk to me about their exit strategy. I'm like, you know, you never start a business to think about when you're going to exit. Just start your business. Go and take care of your employees. Go and take care of your customers. Do great work. And all that other stuff gets sorted out. The market, if we listen, begs the question, if we listen, the market tells us where we are. It's just whether or not we want to listen to it or not.
So this seems to be a good point to take a brief pause. And given that our conversation with Horace, Cote, William, and Phil lasted for about 2 hours, we have decided to cut this podcast into a few parts. We'll be releasing the parts over the course of the next week, and we hope you are enjoying the podcast so far. If you're interested in learning more about what the future of the IT research industry might just look like, take a look at the Analyst Relations Forum 2015. I am very proud to announce that William Tinkup will join us for a panel discussion and Phil First will keynote the event. Thank you for listening to Kia Company's Influencer Insights podcast.